It's Tuesday afternoon, and as always, each and every Tuesday afternoon, we enjoy having a chat to Dr. Ross Walker. This is our last medical chat this year, but I certainly hope the good doctor is going to join us for our special Christmas show on Friday, when we get to find out exactly what sort of Christmas music Dr. Ross Walker likes.
Oh, absolutely, and it's great to talk to you, Brent, as always.
Ross, today we're talking about a couple of things. I was reading an article about this, I think it was only last week, about a heart attack risk that is increased over Christmas. Christmas, the stress of Christmas brings on the potential of an increase in heart attack.
Yeah, this is a really interesting study done out of Sweden where they looked at just under 300,000 heart attacks that were registered in what's called the Swedish Coronary Care Unit Registry, otherwise known as Swedeheart, which I thought was a very nice name.
Yeah.
And this was over a 16-year period between 1998 to 2013. And they found that heart attacks were at much higher rates over holiday periods, and especially the highest rate of all. In Sweden, they have their Christmas celebration on Christmas Eve. So it was 10 p.m. on Christmas Eve, there was a 37% increased risk for heart attack. Now, in our country, many people tend to celebrate Christmas. I know we have Christmas lunch rather than celebrate things on Christmas Eve.
Yeah.
So you've got to ask yourself, why? Why is 10 o'clock, 10 p.m. on a Sunday evening, on Christmas Eve evening, why is that the time that they have much higher rates of heart attacks? Well, the theory is it's probably the excess food, the excess alcohol, and probably the worst thing is the thing that has been termed hypercopresence. I love that term, hypercopresence, which means people, your relatives, and just because you share DNA with people doesn't mean you have to like them.
It's true.
So people you haven't seen for most of the year because you're avoiding them, because you never really liked them in the first place, they all get together at Christmas. And I've seen situations where families get together and there are punch-ups after a few beers over Christmas lunch, and the game of cricket in the backyard, there are punch-ups between the brothers or whatever, and you think to yourself, it's really interesting that people feel this obligation, they've got to get together with people, and often they do, and that's where it all happens. But also, a lot of the times here that people are having heart attacks around this time are people that are at high risk, people with high risk for heart disease, diabetes, etc. And often they're lonely as well. They don't. It's 10 o'clock on Christmas Eve in Sweden, and they haven't seen anyone, so they're feeling a bit depressed about it. And the stress of all that could bring on a heart attack as well. And so it just appears that the stress, the acute stress of the situation can certainly do it. And the risks were more in people over the age of 75, as I said, pre-existing diabetes or heart disease. Interestingly, there was no increased risk on New Year's Eve, but an increased risk on New Year's Day. And that's probably the fact that many people see in the New Year with far too much alcohol. And this is something we've spoken about before, Brent. Alcohol itself is not the problem. The problem is what it's metabolized to, which is a thing called acetaldehyde. So whilst you're drinking, you're feeling good and relaxed and everything's great. But 5 or 6 hours later, you have a huge amount of acetaldehyde in your bloodstream. And that's what makes you sick, and that's what gives you the hangover, and that's what irritates the heart, and irritates your brain, and irritates your liver. So, and you can't avoid acetaldehyde, unfortunately. You can't bypass that step. It goes from alcohol to acetaldehyde and all the problems that go with it. So it appears when Christmas comes along, yes, it's a time for Christmas cheer and celebration with hopefully the people you love, but often it doesn't happen like that.
A true story. I owned a restaurant, and my wife and I owned a restaurant. This is going back probably 15, 16 years. We owned a restaurant. Christmas Day, we used to always do Christmas lunch. And one afternoon, there was a punch-up in the middle of the restaurant between father and son-in-law.
Mm.
Too much booze.
Yep.
Blood flowed from the direct hit that the father-in-law got on the son-in-law.
Oh, yes, and... You see, what happens is what alcohol does, the social lubricant, is just make you more honest. They probably never liked each other in the first place, and just the alcohol over the Christmas lunch gave them the excuse to go for it.
When we were taking the money at the end of the day, one table came up and paid their bill, and there was a $20 tip there, and I said, oh, you know, here's your change, sir. And he said, no, mate, that's the tip for the show.
The entertainment. Oh, that's magnificent.
Tell me what inflammatory bowel disease is.
Okay, you probably... probably heard of the condition Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, yes?
Yes.
Okay. So they're the two very common forms of what we call inflammatory bowel disease. Now, we're not really sure of the actual cause of this, but most people think it's some autoimmune disease. So the immune system goes wrong and attacks the bowel lining to set up either Crohn's or ulcerative colitis. They're not the same conditions. Ulcerative colitis tends to cause a more severe inflammation with bloody diarrhea, whereas Crohn's disease tends to cause more obstruction, abdominal pain, and a whole lot of things. But they're both very serious conditions that can be associated with things like an increased risk for bowel cancer and a whole lot of other things like liver disease and sometimes problems with the joints. But this recent study found that, and let me say, 150,000 people a year in Australia would have inflammatory bowel disease. This recent study of the European Urology Journal, Urology, not Bowel Journal, of 1,000 males with inflammatory bowel disease, comparing them to 9,000 males who didn't have inflammatory bowel disease, found that there was a significant increased risk for prostate cancer. And you say to yourself, why on earth would prostate cancer be associated with a bowel disorder? And the only explanation I can give you is that when you have inflammatory bowel disease, there's a huge amount of inflammation in the lower gut. And the prostate sits pretty close to the lower gut. So all of the immune cells that are overactivated in that area may be doing a whole lot of surveillance on the gut and not doing enough surveillance on the prostate. And as you know, prostate cancer is a pretty common cancer in males. So therefore, the immune cells aren't picking up the fact that the prostate cancer cells are going defective because they're too busy concentrating on the bowel. That's the explanation that's been given for this.
Ross, is it true in reference to prostate cancer that the majority of men, if they live to be old enough, will die with some form of prostate cancer? It may not kill them, the prostate cancer may not kill them, but when they die, they will have prostate cancer.
Oh, absolutely. And can I say that if you took out the prostates of all men over the age of 80, you would find traces of prostate cancer in almost all men. Now, as you so rightly say, they die with it rather than from it. And this has been the dilemma in medicine, is to figure out which prostate cancers are the ones that are going to kill people as opposed to which ones should be left alone. And in fact, one of my best mates, who's one of the top renal physicians in this country, said to me once over dinner, interesting dinner conversation, he said, if anyone measures his PSA level over the age of 65, he'll sue them, because he doesn't believe that they should be checked beyond the age of 65. Now, I'm not saying I totally agree with that, but I certainly think it is a complete waste of time doing PSAs in people who are 80 years old. That's the prostate-specific antigen. And there are newer tests coming through for prostate cancer as well. But the point is, it's very difficult to decide which is which without a prostate biopsy. So when people have a biopsy, they have a test called a Gleason score. And if your Gleason score is well 6 or 7 or above, then that means you've got pretty advanced prostate cancer that needs to be removed. But if you've got a low Gleason score and the PSA is just sort of grumbling along, a lot of doctors would just watch that. But this is just a new risk factor for prostate cancer, which is inflammatory bowel disease, which is something I certainly hadn't heard of before, that there was a link between the two.
For men over the age of 55, is it true that you must just have both tests, the PSA and the digital examination, or what is more important to give you an accurate reading?
Okay, well, can I say a one-off PSA is not a sensible thing to look at. I think you have to look at the trend of PSA, and I would say for men having every 12 to 18 months is a good idea. But to have a rectal examination occasionally is a good thing as well, because with a person who does regular rectal examinations on their patients can feel where if there is a little lump in the prostate, how firm it is, etc. So it's probably good to combine the both. But here's the problem with a PSA. You almost have to cheat for your PSA. So the reason why older guys have more prostate cancer than younger guys, and some women want to hear this and some women don't want to hear it, is that as men get older, they don't tend to empty their prostate as much, i.e. sexual activity.
Right.
So and there's been a number of studies to show that the more sexual activity you have throughout your life, the lower your prostate cancer risk. And I don't think there's any doubt about that. So, but what I say to my patients, if you're having a PSA, don't have it done the day after you've had sex, because up goes your PSA. But also don't have it 2 or 3 weeks after you haven't had sex, because up goes your PSA. But equally, we see on the weekends now all these cyclists cycling around doing their 50K cycle. If they have a PSA the next day, because their perineum, where the prostate is, sits right on the bike, up goes their PSA. So I say to people, have your PSA certainly 2 days after your last piece of sexual activity and your last piece of heavy physical activity, especially cycling. because it can be higher. So if you did a PSA the day after a rectal examination, it'd be through the roof because your prostate's being manipulated, because the thing stands for prostate-specific antigen, not prostate cancer antigen.
What good advice.
Yeah.
Thank you for that.
It's a pleasure.
There's finally two compounds in coffee reduce Parkinson's disease. I'm pleased to have any reason to drink another cup of coffee.
Well, can I say, I've been saying for years that a couple of cups of coffee a day is actually good for your health. So I encourage my patients and myself to have a couple of cups of coffee a day. Now, the studies have shown beyond a doubt that those couple of cups of coffee a day, and we're not talking about 6 to 8 cups, but a couple of cups a day reduces your risk for gallstones, kidney stones, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, many common cancers, type 2 diabetes, depression, stroke, etc., etc. So there's a lot of good reason to have a couple of cups of coffee every day. But the question there is, why? Why is coffee so good for you? Well, this new study out of the proceedings of the National Academy of Science showed that there are two things in coffee, caffeine, which we all know about, of course, and a thing called EHT, which stands for eicosanol 5-hydroxytryptamide. And these are obviously found in the waxy coating of the bean. And they found that when you combine the two things together, it protects against an abnormal brain protein that can lead to Parkinson's disease and a thing called Lewy body dementia, which is one of the less common forms of dementia. So it's good to have a couple of cups of coffee a day. Now, the old days when they used to have the dreadful instant coffee, there was a lot of other horrible substances that whacked your cholesterol through the roof and did all sorts of problems. But these days, even with the more improved instant coffee, and the best one is to get a coffee from the coffee shop, you are getting all of these health benefits that I've said. So it's a good thing to do over Christmas.
What if you drink decaffeinated coffee? Is it the same situation there?
Well, you don't get the caffeine benefit. So, for example, if I drink caffeinated coffee, it actually makes my heart thump, and it's a bit embarrassing for a cardiologist to have palpitations. So I only have decaf coffee. So you won't get the caffeine benefit, but you'll still get the benefits from the what we call polyphenols, which are the strong plant chemicals in the coffee. So it's still good to have the coffee.
If you have been diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, can an extra couple of cups of coffee a day still do you good?
Oh, it'll give you some benefit. But the thing is, and my whole career has been based around one word. It's called prevention.
Yes, okay.
And so what I'm saying, it's good to start early in your life rather than say, oh, look, I'm 75 and I'm getting Parkinson's. I'm going to start drinking coffee because that's going to help. That's too little too late. It's a bit like saying in your 70s, I'll start taking an aspirin. And it's a bit like, I've said this before, taking a multivitamin every day. You should never start taking multivitamin in your 60s and 70s. You should start in your 30s and 40s. The reason being, people as they get older tend to have more cancers brewing somewhere. And if you feed, for example, a multivitamin into somebody who's already got an existing lung or prostate cancer or breast cancer, you can actually feed high-quality nutrients into a part of the body that's actively dividing more than other bits, and so therefore increase the rate of the cancer spread. And that's been shown. So I don't think people should start taking multivitamins or start taking aspirin or start drinking coffee in their 60s and 70s. If you're going to do it, start it younger.
What if you're 60 listening today?
If you're 60 listening today and you've never had coffee before, I wouldn't start because really it's not a habit you've got into. But if it's a habit somebody in their 30s, 40s and 50s enjoys, keep doing your coffee because clearly there's a benefit from it.
If you're 60 today and you haven't taken a multivitamin in life,
I wouldn't start at age 60. But I've been taking multivitamins every day from the age of 30, and I'm 62 now. I've got a zero coronary calcium score. I've got a strong family history of bowel cancer, and it's been shown if you take multivitamins for more than 15 years, you reduce your bowel cancer risk by 75%. My three colonoscopies I've had to date have all been normal with no polyps. My prostate, my PSA is about 0.35, which is incredibly low. I empty it regularly. And I've never smoked in my life.
So. You brag, are you?
No. There's pride in your work and there's arrogance. I'm not being arrogant. But all I'm saying is that I've done all these things. I practice what I preach, and I'm reaping the benefits in my 60s. But I certainly wouldn't start in my 60s taking a multivitamin, but I have been doing it for 30 years and will continue to do so till I drop dead at about age 100.
Good for you. Thank you. What a great chat today. We've learned so many things. Dr. Ross, it's always good to talk to you. Thank you so much. Have a great afternoon, and we'll talk to you on Friday with our Christmas show.
Look forward to it, mate. Thank you.
Thanks, Ross. Bye-bye.